On This Week in Enterprise Tech, here come the Meltdown and Spectre lawsuits. Malware programmers don't trust Bitcoin anymore. Just-in-Time is ticking off Whole Foods customers. And Zoom is here to show you why AI will help you remove your time wasters. Twyet on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Enterprise Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twyet, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 274, recorded January 19th, 2018. Will AI kill time wasters? This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by Command Line Heroes, a new podcast from Red Hat. Listen to the epic true tales of the developers, programmers, hackers, geeks, and open source rebels revolutionizing the technology landscape. Subscribe wherever you get your podcast and visit redhat.com/commandlineheroes today. Welcome to Twyet, This Week in Enterprise Tech. It's the show dedicated to the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and the geek who just wants to know how the world is connected. I'm your host, Father Robert Ballester, the Digital Jesuit, your guide to all things in the enterprise. But of course, I can't guide you by myself. I need a little help from my friends. And my goodness, it's nice to have back this particular friend, Mr. Curtis Franklin. Curtis, it's been a while, my friend. Thank you for coming back onto This Week in Enterprise Tech.
It has been a while, but Padre, it is a great pleasure to be back here on This Week in Enterprise Tech. Look forward to being back for a long time to come. I have to tell you, I missed it.
And we missed you. Well, I was able to catch some of last week's episode. I was actually quite sick at CES, but I thank you to T-Bird. I was able to drop in and say hi just really, really quickly. You did a great job, and I'm so excited to have you back with us. Now, the other person we've got is, of course, Mr. Smash Mouth All-Star himself. That's right. He is the king of the soft focus, Mr. Lou Maresca from Microsoft. Lou, I mean, seriously, you've got the rock star look with that camera angle.
I'm loving it. Although I probably need to learn how to sing for any of the other puns, but we'll see what happens over time.
You know, I'm pretty sure singing talent is pretty much optional in today's pop landscape. So
that's true. A little bit of auto-tune will be good.
Yeah, you got the look. Well, gentlemen, we've got a fun show. Not only are we going to be covering the news, not only do we have to do some wonderful Meltdown and Spectre stuff, but we have a question that we need answering, and that is, can AI help you increase productivity by stopping people from messing around when they're supposed to be working? But as we always do, we got to start with the blips. Now, here come the lawsuits. The fallout from the enterprise-shocking Meltdown and Spectre exploits have reached the full-on legal stage. Now, last week it was a trickle. This week, it's the start of a flood. Yesterday, a 17-page class action lawsuit was filed against Apple at the California District Court in San Jose. Allegedly, Apple intentionally withheld information for months about the chip flaw that affected its iPhones, iPads, and Apple TVs, since they were informed by Google researchers in the summer of 2017. The complaint accuses Apple of continuing to sell iDevices and their vulnerable ARM processors that they knew were defective without warning their customers of the defect, all the while knowing that there would be a performance hit once patched. In seeking class action status, the suit alleges two counts of breach of warranty, one count each of negligence and unjust enrichment, and violations of the New Hampshire Consumer Protection and New York General Business Laws. Now, this is just the start. Apple's x86 products have already been targeted by a suit, and you can expect all major manufacturers to be facing a lawsuit in the near future. The bellwether for us on the enterprise side of the equation is when server manufacturers and cloud service providers, the ones who will actually be feeling the 10 to 30% performance hit once all the patches are out, start to demand reparations. Hang on to your bits. It's going to get bumpy.
Come on, that's just in the movie. The government isn't actually watching you. Well, if you haven't heard, there is something called the FISA Section 702. What is it? Well, it allows U.S. government routinely to collect and search the online communications of any American without a warrant through what are commonly called upstream and PRISM, now called downstream surveillance. Section 702 is a surveillance authority passed as part of the FISA Amendment Act of 2008. That law amended the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act of 1978. Currently, Congress must renew the Section 702 every few years. It was last renewed in 2012. Guess what? It's time to renew it. What do you think? Is it going anywhere? Nope. The renewal bill is headed to the president's desk to renew the bill for the next 6 years since it's passed Congress 65-34. Something interesting happened last year where the NSA announced that they would end the most controversial part of this bill that allowed it to actually surveil Americans who even mentioned foreign targets. This is known as the About Collection. It seems that this isn't the case anymore with this specific bill. If you're worried about the privacy or unsure about the effectiveness of this bill, have your voice heard and speak out to have this vetoed, because the president is the only person in the way of Section 702 becoming active for the next 7 years or 6 years.
How much responsibility do DHS and other government agencies have to tell U.S. citizens and corporations about the hardware and software vulnerabilities they find? How do they decide which to announce and which to hoard? Well, Representative Sheila Jackson Lee of Texas wants to know, and she's filed a bill that would require DHS, at least, to tell her and the rest of Congress. The bill would require DHS to submit an annual report to Congress describing the process the federal government uses to disclose cybersecurity flaws to the private sector and other affected organizations. The bill would also require information about how the department is working with federal agencies and private IT infrastructure managers to mitigate vulnerabilities. Now, this is all much more complicated than it sounds, because the agencies that meet to make decisions on releasing information include the Office of Management and Budget, Office of the Director of National Intelligence, and the Departments of Commerce, State, Treasury, Energy, Defense, and Homeland Security, plus the FBI and the CIA. It's really a question for them of balancing the risks of zero-day attacks versus the ability to use vulnerabilities as espionage and military tools. It sounds like Jackson Lee's bill, though, is a major step towards letting the nation know exactly where that balance lies.
At the end of December, we reported on the Triton malware attack on industrial control systems by Schneider Electric. Now, Triton is a two-stage malware, first using a zero-day to infect the gear, then installing a remote access tool that could be used to inject commands into the control system. If the rat couldn't be installed, the first stage of the malware could still tamper with safety instrument systems and distributed control systems, disabling the equipment's ability to shut itself down in case of an unsafe condition, while also blinding external third-party equipment that could monitor the gear and activate a remote failsafe in case of a critical situation. As these systems are used in manufacturing plants, gas and oil fields, and nuclear facilities, that was considered a bad thing. Well, researchers have taken a more thorough look at Triton, and it's worth a read. First, the control systems ran PowerPC chips with proprietary hardware and software. So even finding, not to mention exploiting, a zero-day was a resource-intensive task. Second, the number of control systems that could be infected by Triton were deliberately limited to certain models. Since the zero-day required physical access to the control systems, the attackers had to have an intimate knowledge of how they were used, where they might be located, and which subsystems were most likely to be networked to the controllers. Finally, Triton was designed to slowly increase its control over a network of control systems, ingratiating itself into the various layers of built-in emergency shutdown protocols. It was only discovered because it accidentally triggered a shutdown during one of its probes. And as a result, we never actually saw the payload that the malware was supposed to deliver. All of this points to a serious escalation of malware. This was a targeted attack, most likely at a plant in the Middle East, not just something released into the wild. And the scariest bit of this story is that the best case scenario is that this is a state level actor. The worst case scenario is that attacks of this sophistication are now available to non-state actors.
You ever try to bring something through customs and were slapped on the wrist or told to throw it out? What if you didn't even know you had something with you that you had to throw out? What if you just were essentially put on a blacklist because you had this thing? Well, it looks like there's something else that's coming along into reality. Even if you order things over Amazon, if you order items on Amazon that end up being counterfeit, you're now put on a blacklist and flagged by customs, especially if you try to get pre-approved for the Trusted Traveler program. An engineer from PayPal ordered a suitcase on Amazon only to never receive it by and actually getting an unannounced refund from Amazon. Following year, when they tried to actually renew their status for the Trusted Traveler program, which is basically a pre-approved or low-risk traveler system for people who are traveling a lot, offered the United States, Customs and Border Protection actually denied that program for them. And so you say WTF, what does this mean? Well, a spokesperson from CBP confirmed that having past violations of custom laws or regulations on your record can make you ineligible for the Trusted Traveler program. Accidental or not, you're on the list. You can appeal it, but it would take months and so most likely not actually go through. I guess the best option is to not buy on Amazon. I guess maybe go buy it from the actual retailer owns the device and product. I'm not sure that's great for Amazon. So we'll see if they correct this and cut down on it in the future.
We all know that encrypted tunnels are the way to go for secure web browsing, but Mozilla is taking it a step farther and requiring that all future Firefox features that involve browser-to-server communications, and let's be honest, for a browser, that's pretty much all of them, use a link that starts with HTTPS. What kind of features are we talking about here? In a post to a company blog, Mozilla engineer Ann Van Kesteren wrote, "A feature can be anything from an extension of an existing IDL-defined object, a new CSS property, a new HTTP response header, to bigger features such as WebVR." Now, it's likely that other browser publishers will follow suit because of secure context, which is dubbed minimum level security level, and that's a pending standard of the World Wide Web Consortium. Secure context's main purpose, according to its documentation, is application code with access to sensitive or private data be delivered confidentially over authenticated channels that guarantee data integrity. Now, all this shouldn't surprise anyone. Mozilla first announced intentions to require HTTPS in April of 2015. Others, including Google, have been leaning on web publishers to move to HTTPS since 2014. There are still millions of pages out there doing business in the clear, though. It will be interesting to see whether these new mandates finally convince companies and individuals to truly encrypt their traffic.
We all know that Bitcoin suffers price fluctuations like movie divas suffer mood swings. But that volatility has become a hallmark of Bitcoin, even a strength, as the volatility appeals to those with a desire for quick financial action. However, there is one industry that apparently has had enough of Bitcoin's roller coaster ride: malware. Once the de facto payment standard for ransomware, the number of ransomware packages demanding payment in Bitcoin fell 73%. In the last quarter of 2017. For all the yucks, there is actually some fascinating information to glean from this factoid. First, ransomware works best when the attacker prices their ransom just before the pay threshold. That's the point at which rebuilding the data becomes more attractive than paying the ransom. This is made far more difficult to do when the price of the ransom can fluctuate several thousands of dollars in hours. Secondly, while holders of Bitcoin have enjoyed, then hated, then enjoyed, and probably once again hated the ride, those trying to accept or send payment with the cryptocurrency have found it notably stomach-churning and not at all positive. Back to the practical, Bitcoin will not disappear as a ransom payment option, but more and more malware packages will find a way to ask for a fiat currency to ensure that they can price their ransomware appropriately and get paid. That does it for the blips. Next up, we've got the bites, and we need to talk a little bit about just-in-time logistics. But before we get to that, let's take a moment to thank a sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Now, This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by Command Line Heroes. It's a brand of a new original podcast for geeks by geeks from Red Hat. Now, Command Line Heroes is dedicated to telling the epic true tales of the developers, programmers, hackers, geeks, and open source rebels who are revolutionizing the technology landscape. Now, what's a Command Line Hero? You might be one if you've ever taken something apart to see how it works. You know, a hacker, a maker, a DIYer. Or maybe you'd rather make something instead of just using it. Command Line Heroes are the makers, the builders, the dreamers, the innovators, the doers who are transforming tech and shaping our tomorrow. Command Line Heroes is produced by Red Hat. It's an open source company. You've heard of them. This is the Enterprise Show. You've definitely heard of them. They started at an apartment 25 years ago, and they know a few things about where tech came from and where it's going. And it's hosted by none other than Suran Yidbarek. That's right, the developer who founded Code Newbie, hosts two other tech podcasts, and lives and breathes open source software. Now, here's what you're going to hear when you go to Command Line Heroes. Each episode goes deep on a topic that we techies care about. The first season alone covers the OS wars, going back to the 80s, how Linux came to be, covering the desktop front and the battle for the data center, the development of the Agile movement, the story of DevOps, and those caught doing battle in the cloud. And that's just the start. This isn't just another podcast. This isn't a new show. This is a way for you to understand the history of the industry that you care so much about. We want you to be informed. We want you to be smarter. We want you to be a Command Line Hero. Visit redhat.com/commandlineheroes. That's redhat.com/commandlineheroes. Subscribe to Command Line Heroes wherever you get your podcasts. And visit redhat.com/commandlineheroes for extras and to learn more. Again, that's redhat.com/commandlineheroes. And we thank Red Hat and Command Line Heroes for their support of this week in Enterprise Tech. Let's get back to the action. Now, we all know about just-in-time logistics. It's the holy grail of real-time logistics. It's getting materials into position just before they are required for the manufacturing, for the packaging, the shipping, or the retail processes that we need to make modern life work. Now, if you don't have raw materials or processed product in any storage or staging point for longer than absolutely necessary, then that means that you've done your job to perfection. You've mastered just-in-time and maximized the productivity of your logistics chain. Now, JIT is a mantra, never quite achieved, but always sought after by every large manufacturer, retailer, and provider of services. And one of its biggest proponents, Amazon, has turned JIT into an art form. Whether it's how they handle their stock in the warehouse or their services and how they're provisioned in the AWS cloud, JIT is what makes Amazon tick. Unfortunately, it seems that Amazon doesn't quite have the JIT formula down for its newest venture, the acquired Whole Foods. Now, their stores have been facing food shortages because of the JIT system, which they call OTS, or order to shelf. Now, here's how OTS is supposed to work. First, backstock is greatly reduced. In most cases, backstock is 25% of what it was before OTS. Now, in one store, the meat department and seafood department, which once had a freezer each to store inventory, now shares a single freezer. Secondly, stock should theoretically go directly from trucks to the shelves. When it's working right, that's exactly how it should work. Now, there are a strict set of requirements that make this work. It's for purchasing, storing, and displaying products on shelves. A manager will regularly walk the aisles and storage rooms for which he or she are responsible for. Now, they are responsible for everything from making sure that labels are facing the right way to not having excess stock. Now, if the area is sloppy, especially if there's too much inventory, the manager of that area gets a write-up. After 3 write-ups, you lose your job. Parts of OTS have been successful. They have greatly reduced spoilage. They have seen cost savings go up, and the supply chain has shortened, which are all hallmarks of an Amazon business. However, there have been some major drawbacks. First, empty shelves. You can see them on the screen right now. These are photos from actual Whole Foods stores. In one store, they ran out of onions and potatoes. Now, entire aisles will go empty if a truck breaks down or a shipment is delayed. Also, customers are getting angry because they have to make multiple trips to get everything that they want. And employee morale is down because their once loyal customers are now berating them for something that's completely beyond their control. Now, Lou, let me pull you into this. Because at its core, OTS or JIT is all about shifting away power from the local buyer. It's saying, look, you may have feet on the ground, but we have a better view of the battlefield. We understand how it works overall. And that's a good theory, but I'm wondering if that works in a model like Whole Foods. I mean, Whole Foods is a premium brand. It's a premium store. The whole idea is that you go in, you get locally sourced products, you get that local feel. And so even though it's a national chain, people still feel like it's a farmer's market. Obviously, there's something wrong. Can JIT or OCS or whatever they want to call it work in a more premium model like Whole Foods?
I think it can. I think that, one angle at this is I actually don't feel sorry for them that they're running into this problem because, you know, Amazon being very well known for using machine learning models internally to predict customer changes. They use machine. I know developers that work there, and they'll use machine learning models to determine, how long somebody's going to work in a day, let alone, when do they have products in stock or not. And so, even from a JIT model perspective, when it comes to actually stocking things, having models to actually predict the need for products over time, over the time of the day, is something they should have already. Like, for instance, why is Walmart so successful and being able to keep their costs down is because they've been for years been using machine learning models to predict their costs, to not only determine when they're going to run out something in the future, based off of sales or trends or demographics, when the product is going to go in or out, or if they're going to run out of something, let's say in a part of the day, and if they need to get some more in. And so I think that these are perfect examples of what Whole Foods should be doing, no matter if they're a high-end or not. They're still producing a product that can be easily tweaked by using the data that's supported. And so, I don't necessarily feel sorry for Whole Foods here. It sounds like they need to go to their parent company now and say, hey, help us devise the correct models here so we have to stop having this problem.
See, I'm with you. I believe that it's a data problem. I believe that you can fix this by looking at something like machine learning and getting it to understand how the local part of that national organization actually works versus how it works at, say, an Amazon warehouse. But Curtis, here's the thing that I think is a disconnect, which is, again, Whole Foods is supposed to be different. That's what made them Whole Foods in the first place. They aren't a Walmart. They're not a big box store. They're not supposed to have aisles and aisles of stock of generic brands that you can buy everywhere else. They're supposed to make you feel special. I mean, that's why people are willing to pay 10, 15% more for the exact same can of X sauce or X product at a Whole Foods than they are at a Safeway. Can you account for that in that big data problem? I mean, is there a field that you can start to complete to say, hey, you know what? Having an empty shelf of that local product is point whatever percent of the algorithm, and that has to be considered over having too much stock.
I think they can. The issue that they have just in time is a wonderful system for running a supply chain. Its big weakness is that it is brittle. When it breaks, it breaks ugly. And there's not an awful lot of flexibility built into the typical just-in-time system. So what they're going to end up doing, I think, and I hope that their new parent company will be able to help them with this, is figure out where they need to have some resilience built in, where they need to have some flexibility built in, and where that resilience and flexibility needs to physically live. The food service industry is one where supply chain is complicated, it's brittle, and it's something that a lot of people worry about. You know, I remember a year ago sitting down with someone at SAP's Sapphire conference, and I was talking with the CIO of a large dairy co-op. This is a company that everyone would know. You see their products on the store shelves. But he was talking about the problems that occur because the milk is carried to cheesemakers in tank trucks that are not refrigerated. It's at a particular temperature when it leaves the dairy, and it has to only so much time to get to the cheesemaker before it goes out of safe handling. And so if something happens like a flat tire or a breakdown on a truck, this is a major problem. Well, Whole Foods has this kind of problem on a much larger scale. So I think what they need, as Lou indicated, is some judicious application of AI, some tremendous application of experience from their new parent company, and the addition of some resilience to a very brittle JIT system.
Right, right. I actually like that. And I like the comments that we're getting in our chat room right now. Chumley makes the point of, you know, In-N-Out doesn't have fridges, and yet they've been growing and growing and growing. Obviously, there is a way to do this. Even when you're dealing with perishables, especially with meat perishables, you know, obviously there's a solution that works in scale. You've got Chumley who is saying that it's only going to get more brittle, talking about this brittle JIT as more and more competition opens up. And in fact, if I was a competitor right now, I would smell blood in the water. You know, Whole Foods has had this market cornered for so long. They've had that upper echelon of upper middle class, lower upper class that only shops at Whole Foods. Well, if that shopper comes to his or her local Whole Foods and sees empty shelves, or suddenly has to go to Safeway because the three ingredients that they needed that they couldn't find at Whole Foods were there, they've suddenly lost all of those years of building up that brand. And yeah, that's a problem. But Lou, let me go back over to you. Is the answer to start building up stock again? Because, I mean, JIT works when you don't have stock. JIT has its best efficiencies when you can go directly from the truck to the shelf. So in that sense, this is working. OTS does work, except for the fact that they're not accounting for customers, and they're not accounting for customers getting ticked, and they're definitely not accounting for customers getting ticked who will then never come back. I mean, I know I already asked, but how do you solve this? What's the module you turn on? What's the little bit of algorithm that you tweak to say, okay, we need to give managers a bit more leeway in having excess stock, because the one time they do have excess stock is way better than the five times that they don't.
I think Curtis kind of alluded slightly to it as well. Is I think, you know, like for instance, in a recurrent neural network, you have different facets of the model that you can actually tweak and add additional points to it. And I think, like for instance, he talked about perishable items where people, you know, usually stop by a grocery store or so on to get milk or eggs or something that's really common. And I think having a buffer in that area where you can't necessarily predict those areas makes sense. I know that the pictures are showing like salad and other things. I mean, those things are a little harder because, you know, having those types of things in stock. I mean, that's just ridiculous. There is not having enough kale or something like that. You know, looks like they have too much kale actually. So I think dinosaur kale looks like. But anyways, I think that you know, they should know which items based off of historical data what they need to have an additional buffer for. And again, these things like milk and eggs and you know, common things that people just go to the store to get. That they're expecting to be there will have less of a problem. You know, people will be less annoyed when they can go to Whole Foods and buy their organic non-GMO milk versus, you know, not having dinosaur kale. So I think that those are types of things that I think the company needs to weigh it out and start doing a little bit more, is having that little bit of a buffer, having that back stock for specific things.
Right, right. And the funny thing is, if you scroll through those pictures that come with the stories, I mean, I understand running out of organic produce. I mean, that's okay. That's a sourcing thing. We can fix that. And, you know, we won't increase spoilage that much. But there's also shelves of canned goods that are empty. And I'm thinking, if you've got a decent JIT system, you should never run out of canned goods. Canned goods have such a good shelf life that you're not going to have excess stock. And that's the bit of the crushed morale when you've got shelves and shelves that look like they're in a third world country because some manager has decided that they're not going to take the risk that they have one extra can and suddenly they get one of their three strikes. So I think they're going to get this figured out. I think both of you are right in that this is a data problem, and there's just a couple of fields that they don't yet have. They're not yet considering. I think Whole Foods in Austin is going to lean on Amazon and say, what are we doing wrong? You know, we're trying to adopt to your way of doing business, but I think we may have swung a bit too much. And they'll get this settled out. Either that or Amazon just wasted a lot of money on a premium brand that they're turning into a regular brand. Anything else you want to mention about this? Because JIT is not going to go away. It is a big topic. And hopefully we can have a guest on at some point and talk about using something like the shot put to do more JIT.
I one more comment. I think, you know, if you look at those pictures, they almost look staged. Because if you've ever been to a grocery store, it just seems to me like they were cleaning out the cases here because, you know, like you said, canned foods is just ridiculous. They're going to know when they start to run low in stock. Their data is going to tell them this. I can't imagine a brand that big is going to have this problem. I just, I almost feel like these are staged. That's all I want to throw out there.
Unless those were cans of dinosaur kale, because, I mean, yeah, that goes right. fast.
Right.
I mean, I buy like 50 cans anytime I'm in Whole Foods. Actually, you know, I will make a confession here. I've never shopped at a Whole Foods in my life. I've walked into a Whole Foods and said, no. Whole Food shoppers, the two of you?
I am a Whole Food shopper for certain things. Now, I will admit that when I travel, I lean on Whole Foods salad and prepared foods for healthy meals because I know that I can get something there. And I will also give them a plug. Over a year ago when our son got married on very short notice, the bakery at Whole Foods turned around a gorgeous wedding cake for a very reasonable price with very short notice. So they get kudos for that. For normal stuff, I like their peanut butter.
Yeah, our TD hates peanut butter because it makes him die. For me, I think I'm just not high class enough for Whole Foods. For me, high class is Trader Joe's. When I go to Trader Joe's or IKEA, IKEA, they have meatballs. That's about as good as it gets for me. Gentlemen, that's it. That's all the time we have for this bite because we do have to get on to our guest. And at this point, we'd like to welcome to the show Roy Pereira. He is the CEO of Zoom. And he's here to talk about how AI can help you reduce time spoilage. Yeah, I just coined that term in your workplace. Roy, we thank you for coming on to This Week in Enterprise Tech.
Hey, thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Now, this book that you've written, The Future of Work, Will AI Be and Analytics Be the Key to Killing Time Wasters? It points to something that I think we're seeing more and more in the enterprise today, and that is using machine learning, deep learning, to look at where you can improve efficiencies. Can you tell me a little bit about what your work found?
Sure. So automation and AI or machine learning, as you mentioned, are critical pieces to increasing productivity within the workforce. We found that as supporting staff is removed from modern enterprises, it's replaced with applications that can help employees do their day-to-day jobs. The problem is that instead of increasing productivity, the number of applications reaching 20 actually starts to decrease productivity and leave employees quite unhappy with the way that they are able to not do their real work because they're spending so much time on all of these apps. And so with automation backed by artificial intelligence with machine learning, we're able to increase that productivity again by automating a lot of their common tasks by integrating into all of these applications that they have to utilize.
Let's talk a little bit about that. That number, that 20, is there something magical about that number of applications? Is it okay at 18 and at 22 it's a disaster? Or how do you chart that?
Certainly not. The 20 is actually an average number of applications that most employees at knowledge-based enterprises have to use. And they're given, you know, logins by their IT department or by their HR department to go and log in. And it almost seems like no one is really looking at the total amount of time required to log in and to do little things at all of these applications. And then the other problem that actually happens is much like we can only remember 7 digits in a phone number, after a while you stop remembering where to go to do what because you have too many apps. And so 20 is not the trigger. It's much less than that.
Okay. So at what point would you say is the low end? When do employees start getting frustrated with having to jump from app to app to app to app? I mean, ideally, there'd be one. There'd be the portal, the app, the one that contains all of the work that they need to do, all of the data that they need to do that work. But of course, we're never there. But at what point do I start to say, I've got a problem? I'm trying to overload my workforce.
Right. So it's when you're approaching around 10 or so, it's becoming harder for you to remember where to go. And that singular interface that you actually brought up is really key because we are actually trying to get there. We believe that chat is going to be that singular interface into your workday. The problem today is that there's too many back office applications again you know, from your Office 365 to your Salesforce and everything else. Chat has the ability, because it's also a one interface, it's a natural interface. If it was able to interface with all of the applications, you would only have one. And again, you wouldn't need any extra training. You wouldn't need any extra login. And so this is what we're seeing with our enterprise customers. The other bit about chat is that if you talk to anyone under 35, that's really all they want to do is actually be on chat, not bring in another application or even go on a website. So we believe that that's actually the next user interface of choice in the enterprise.
Oh, it's interesting. I kind of want to back this off a bit. I will be asking you about what a typical workday would look like, because I'm assuming that you've observed users to see what their usage patterns are like. I'd love to see, you know, user logs in and then needs to move to this application and then this application. But on a more personal level, I have watched my work environment evolve over the years as I've moved from a single stationary computer to maybe a computer with multiple screens to now a computer with multiple screens and mobile devices, and I'm using them all at the same time with their own use cases and their own applications. So is the advent of the multi-app workday just a regular part of the evolution of work, or do you see that as a real detriment? I mean, is it a dead end? Are we getting to the point where we have so many applications open that we just never get any work done?
We are definitely seeing that. When we calculated all of the time wasters, it was 33% of the day. And if you were a salesperson, it was closer to 50% of the day because you had to do so much work on a CRM. And it's, you know, it's 2018. We shouldn't be doing all of this work. Computers are here to help us, not to make us their slaves, which is really what it's turning out to be because of all of these applications. And it's interesting that, you know, you talk about all of these multi-devices and all this. It's almost like we need three arms. Right. You know, if someone invented a third arm, everybody would have more phones to do more things. But that's not going to happen, hopefully.
I think there's an app for that, actually.
And so what we're trying to do, again, with chat, we believe that chat in any of the applications, it could be, you know, Facebook Messenger, it could be Slack, it could be Microsoft Teams. But it also could be texting. And so regardless of whether you're sitting down at your desktop or you just get up and go for a walk and you're on your phone, you should be able to continue that conversation and to continue to do work.
Okay. Oh, I've heard this before. I mean, at Enterprise Connect every year in Orlando, they always talk about convergence and hyperconvergence. And I'm sure there'll be another word added to convergence this year. But it's difficult sometimes to move from the conceptual stage to an actual product and understanding how it's working. You talked about automating repetitive tasks. You've talked about reducing the number of apps you need because you're using AI to get rid of some of those time wasters. So I'm going to ask you for some very concretes here. Explain to me what you would consider a time waster, and then explain to me how do I engineer away that time waster? How do I use AI to automate something that gets rid of that loss of productivity?
Sure. You know, a lot of people talk about meeting scheduling as a huge time waster. We support that. We support the entire full life cycle. But I'm not going to give you that example because that one we've heard about already. The other example I'm going to tell you about is 20% of an employee's time is wasted by trying to find information, discover where the information is, and discover what it is. And this was a study done by Harvard Business Review. And so things as simple as what is the Wi-Fi password on the second floor will stop employees to be productive because they'll just keep asking. And it won't just be that employee. It'll be other employees that get asked that question. And so, for example, we're able to suck in the knowledge of the company into the assistant that is on chat and is accessible everywhere. And then we're also able to tie into the back office applications and search through those applications for other bits of information, right? Because everything now is in the cloud. It's all in the Dropbox or in the Drives or in Salesforce, and it's stuck there. And we may not know exactly where to go. And so through chat, we're able to automate a lot of those processes by just asking for a simple, you know, what is X or Y? So those are two concrete examples. The other example is finding files, but also manipulating those files. So we all have documents that we have to generate as employees, whether it's a sales contract or an employee contract or an NDA. And those can get very complicated to figure out who is managing them, how do I fill that out, and so forth. And so, again, chat is a perfect UI for that example. And by leveraging the AI, the machine learning models that we've built, we can anticipate and predict what our end users are actually asking for and streamline all of those processes so that we're not asking 10 different questions. We're getting to exactly what we believe they actually want to do. And so that minimizes the time that they actually need to do.
Okay, we actually do have a video from you guys that does a pretty good job of explaining how the process actually works. But before we get that, I do want to get to one question from the chat room. We've got Specs, who is a longtime listener to the show, who wonders if there's a significant threshold for qualifying as a time waster. I mean, when you look at the problem in the macro view, how do you classify something as, that needs automation?
So I get asked a lot of times what jobs are going away because of automation in AI. And I like to answer that most of the jobs are not going to go away. They're just going to get augmented, where the AI and the automation is going to augment your job so that you can actually work at a higher level. And I think to answer your question, I would ask someone to do an audit trail of the tasks that they do every day and to check which ones could be actually automated because they're lower value and they're repetitive. Computers are really good at that, and automation, especially with the new artificial intelligence machine learning models that we now have, they're able to find information within a haystack of data much, much better than we can as humans. And so that bumps up what we as humans should be really doing in the workday instead of the repetitive, low-value tasks.
Right. Okay, well, let's go ahead and queue up the video here because I think we need a really good description of exactly how Zoom uses AI to find and automate the time wasters. So let's go ahead and we can talk along.
This is a video that Microsoft and Zoom put together, and it kind of looks at how Zoom is integrated into the Microsoft stack. This is actually our office and one of our guys, and most enterprises have Microsoft products. They could have also Google products in the back end. We support both. And it's about making an employee's day much more productive and obviously happier so that they can actually do the real job, so they can go home fulfilled. And it's really about saving time, right? Because we have quite a lot of things that are wasting our time during the day. And you can see here an interface. It's chat. This happens to be Microsoft Teams. And Jesse here, who's the star of this video, is looking at setting up a meeting. He's looking at transcribing a call so that he doesn't have to take notes and that we're actually using natural language processing to analyze the transcription. As you can see here, they're going onto a call there.
A phone call with that person when they answer.
Can you send me the statement of work?
I hang up. I'm going to get an email, and that email is going to have exactly what was said over the call. With the Zoom document generator feature, we create a document, request a document to be created for someone through chat. It'll ask us a few questions. And when
what are you using for the text-to-speech engine?
The completed document from that template.
So the text-to-speech engine is not something that we built, or speech-to-text.
Right.
Yeah. So we're using an API for that. But the natural language processing and the machine learning are actually our built-in technologies. And in fact, we've rebuilt the natural language processing engine four times now. You have to understand that chat is a very different medium than other mediums that have come before it. And it's doesn't have a lot of data, especially when you're on your phone. You know, you're thumb typing and you want to type in as least possible. And so it doesn't give us a lot of data to work with. So we actually have to build everything in-house.
Okay, I like this. And you can basically integrate your solution with any suite. I mean, this one is Microsoft's, but let's say an enterprise has their own custom suite that they designed. The AI from Zoom can just fit in. I mean, if it's doing NLP, if it's looking at chat, essentially any questions that get asked, it can tap its database.
That is correct. So it's really important for us to work with existing infrastructure, right? We go into an enterprise and it's not a homogeneous environment anymore. It's not just Microsoft. It could also have a Salesforce CRM. It could have a Workday application or a Zendesk support application. And so we do support quite a large amount of applications. And of course, chat, especially in North America, there is no one single chat application that rules everything. In China, WeChat kind of dominates, but in North America, that doesn't exist. And so we do support 16 different chat platforms. I think the other thing to remember is a lot of us are on chat outside, you know, in the social life. You know, we're on social media like Facebook Messenger, or we text our friends. And when we come into work, we actually want to continue to work that way. And so maybe the enterprise has Slack, maybe they have Microsoft Teams, but we're also on some other messenger platforms. And so for us, that's fine. You can work exactly how you want to work and continue on multiple channels.
I want to bring my co-host back into the conversation. Curtis, let me throw this to you. We've seen this kind of technology in the enterprise, but mostly it's been used for things like customer relations. You know, I want a bot that can answer questions from someone who might be irate on Twitter or maybe sending an email. This is a different use case. It may use a lot of the same chunks of technology, but when you're working inside of the framework of an enterprise, of a workforce, you don't have to program your intelligence to handle things like trolling or someone trying to misuse the system. Have you seen a lot of this already in use?
I tell you, I have seen people presenting use cases. I have seen a handful of companies. I know that when I was at the Gartner Symposium last fall, there were a number of companies exhibiting there and a number of companies talking about what they were doing. And the idea of using bots basically to drive down this total cost of ownership that people like to talk about, which translates in this case out to lowering the support costs, because as we've seen, there are all kinds of relatively repetitive support questions that come in a large enterprise. They know, for example, when an application changes anything in the user experience, they're going to get a flood of calls. They know kind of what those are. So bots are ideal at that because it frees up human time. So I think we're beginning to see this. We're still in the early stages, but this is definitely, by this, I mean the internal support and internal use of bots, something that a lot of larger companies especially are very interested in.
Now Roy, what's the ultimate end goal of Zoom? I mean, because you are a technology that enables other technologies, and it puts you in a very interesting position. What's your 5-10 year plan for Zoom?
You are correct. So it's almost like we're middleware, right? We're the bridge between the new user interface, which is chat, and the traditional office applications. And not just a bridge, but we're also adding automation, and we're leveraging artificial intelligence to make that automation intelligent. And so we believe that's a really large market. It's definitely needed as we move into this new UI of chat. And it's also needed because most enterprises have so many different applications and they don't necessarily talk to one another. Plus, of course, the productivity increase. And you mentioned large companies, large enterprises. This is what we're seeing, because when you add up the numbers of cost savings, right, if you're saving an employee 10 hours a month, 15 hours a month, and you multiply that out by 10,000 employees, by an average salary, Well, you're looking at over $100 million of savings in a year. And this is what our customers are coming to us with. And so we do get quite a lot of larger enterprises around the world coming in and using us.
Right. Now, Lou, let me drag you in here because, you know, this obviously the demonstration showed it working with a Microsoft suite. And, you know, this is sort of a natural tool for something that's going to be used in a team. Where do you see the future of AI, deep learning, and natural language processing for something like Office 720 or whatever the next one's going to be called?
You know, it's all, you know, like you said, it's already a realization. I think chatbots and have been built in, you know, as part of a framework, even to Microsoft Teams from the beginning. And I think that same thing with Spark. I'm sorry, the other Slack, I think they call it, the other competitor. And I think that, you know, this type of analytics is something really important. Like you said, it comes important. Like when you're at a team and you're talking and you need some information about a customer, or you know, and there's nobody there listening. You know, you have a chat system and it's a Teams based system, and you chat out there, there's nobody listening. But you know, in this case, you have some AI that's listening, and you need some information about a customer. This is a great opportunity to just ask the system about it, and that can basically query that data. So I think it's going to be fine-grained. It's going to be ingrained in the next generation of applications and platforms. And I think, you know, it will get even farther. And I think he talked about it a little bit is, you know, new, especially people who are starting out in companies or organizations, they need to find ways to discover things. And sometimes just using chat is the easiest method to do that, because it can ask natural questions to the system, and it can provide the data that it has, you know, proprietary data that's, you know, not part of a search engine anywhere. It's proprietary data within the system and within the organization, and chat's just a natural way to kind of get yourself bootstrapped. And so I think it's definitely going to be ingrained in the systems going forward.
You know, it's interesting because as we've been having this conversation, I've been thinking of all the things that I would like to automate. And some of them are really simple, like, you know, what's the Wi-Fi password on the second floor? And others would be, well, who do I need to talk to get this project approved? And those are things that, yeah, that's absolutely automatable. But then I got to ask, Roy, I mean, this is a cool technology, and we've got Chumley in the chat room who really likes it and would like to see this in use in his organization. But this, to me, it sounds like something that companies like Microsoft, companies like Google, companies like Amazon will want to build for themselves. What makes you secure in Zoom? What's your special sauce? What's the thing that you think you've got that they can't easily replicate that says, No, their tools are years behind. Ours are ready to go now. This is the firm you work with.
You know, we see Microsoft as a very important partner, and they are. They're very active, both with sales and support of technology and integrations. Maybe it's a bit of co-opetition, but what we've built is light years ahead of what anyone else has built. And we're in a very unique layer. We're not building the chat application. We're not competing there. We're not building the Office application. What we're building is making both of them better. We've built the technology over the last 2 years that is much, much farther ahead than anyone else in the industry. And so today we're working with both Microsoft and Google. Our largest customer actually is on Google, for example, but the majority of customers that we have are on Microsoft. And we're working with all of the other applications to enhance the ability for employees to use them. And so I think that there is a category of enterprise software that is needed that is not necessarily part of one large vendor. Because if it is part of one large vendor like Microsoft, then it's really all around Microsoft's products, not everyone else's. And like I said, all of the enterprise customers that we deal with are not homogeneous. They have lots of different vendors in there. And so they really need a trusted third party to integrate all of that in.
Okay. All right. I like this. Now, as we look into the future, and I want to go back to you, Curtis. I want to be excited. I want to say that I want to see this working in my next productivity suite. But I've heard promises like this before. I mean, this has been something that the industry has said would be around a decade ago. And the examples of it that we got weren't great. And yes, this does look like a good demo, and it does look like Zoom's got some technology and they've got some cooperation that gives them an edge up on previous efforts. But what do you think was the missing piece back then? And what do you think they need to do now to make sure that it takes?
You know, I'm going to go back to something that I learned from my son, the game designer. He talked about the uncanny valley, and this is something that typically arises in visual things, where there is just a little bit of a variance in how something appears. It's almost realistic, but not quite. And that tends to make people really uncomfortable. People want something that's either entirely fake and obviously fake, or they want to believe that they're dealing with a human being. Well, the same thing has been true with these chatbots. And what I think is happening now is that they're getting good enough where for most values of the questions that people ask, we're crossing that uncanny valley. And what I think the difference is that in many situations, people have been dealing with chatbots and either they haven't known it. They have believed that they were dealing with another human being, or they realized that they were dealing with a chatbot and they were okay with it. And so I think that's really the key, that they've gotten good enough so that users are willing to deal with them on their own terms. And that makes them exceptionally valuable, because now all of a sudden they can be accepted by people. And they became used to this in their lives as consumers. And just like a lot of other technology that started on the consumer side and moved to the enterprise, now they're willing to see these chatbots used in the enterprise. They know that if they ask a question that's too complex, the system knows enough to kick them to a human being. But for most purposes, they just want the information. And if it comes to them in the guise of a bot, that's great.
Oh, Roy, what does your information tell you about that? I mean, people are okay with bots, right? As long as they get the information, they're fine, especially if they understand that it's part of the software that they're working with.
You know, just to add on to the answer there, we believe that machine learning gives us the unfair advantage and makes our solution successful as opposed to previous generations of solutions. Machine learning adds that intelligence. You know, software since day one has been pretty dumb. It doesn't compare with humans. And so machine learning allows us to do predictions, to read between the lines of what the human user is actually wanting to do with the system. And that's the advantage that we're using to make this more successful than anything else that we've seen in the past.
So Roy, Simply Insights has, they have natural language querying engine, and I know you guys actually acquired them recently. How has this kind of changed your business for the better?
Sure. So Simply Insights acquisition was about their translation technology. They were able to translate English into SQL, which is a database query language, if anyone out there is a techie. And so you would say things like, show me the revenue for last month and break it down by product. And it would be able to figure out which databases to go and query, generate those queries, bring in all the data, join it, and then figure out the visualization required for that. In this case, it would be a pie chart or maybe a bar graph. And so we're adding that technology into our suite of skills, we call, and it'll be yet another skill that the enterprise employee will be able to harness. Of course, it's all backed by access control, so not everyone will have access to all the data, but those employees that do will be able to just ask the question to their assistant in chat and get the answer very quickly without having to go to a human, for example.
Curtis, Lou, any last thoughts, anything that you want to interject, anything that we need to know about AI in the enterprise?
It's coming.
It's here.
It's here. It actually is here. Roy Pereira, the CEO of Zoom, I want to thank you so very much for joining us. If you could please speak directly to our audience, if they wanted to find out more about you, if they wanted to find out more about Zoom, if they wanted to find out more about the use of AI in their applications, in their software, their services, where do they go?
Zoom.ai.
Thank you very much for joining us, and we thank you for being part of the Twiat Riot. Now, folks, unfortunately, you've done it again. You've used up another hour listening to the best dang enterprise podcast in the universe. That's according to 9 out of 10 enterprise AI bots. I want to thank everyone who made this show possible. Of course, to our guest, Roy Pereira, the CEO of Zoom, for all of the knowledge that he has dropped on the Twiat Riot. And yes, to my co-host, without which I would not want to do this show. We got to start with Curtis Franklin. Curtis, it is so nice to be working with you again. I'm so happy to have you back. And I'm so looking forward to the weeks and weeks of being able to spend Fridays with you geeking out to the enterprise. Where can people find you? Where can people find your work? And where do you hang your hat these days?
Well, Padre, just at the moment, I'm hanging my hat in the great land of freelance. So the place to keep up with me right now is on Twitter. I'm at KG4GWA. You can also look for me on LinkedIn, LinkedIn/Curtis Franklin. I'm posting some stuff there. I've got a personal blog that I'll be posting some links to, but still trying to figure out what comes next in terms of long term. But I'm glad that this week in enterprise tech is definitely a part of that long term, whatever the rest of it's going to be.
Indeed. And actually, I think I'm going to be out your way sometime in March. Hopefully we can get some face to face time, and then we can talk all about Chibert getting ill on a cruise ship. That sounds fun. Lou Maresca. Now, the audience didn't see it because we were at break, and unfortunately it's going to be cut out. But I did notice that your room at any given time has been filled with kids that are kind of blurry or a dog that's kind of blurry. You've got an active life. Where can people find out more about the Lou?
Well, you can always find me on twitter.com/LouMM. And of course, all my work that I do is dev.office.com. Check out Office add-ins and all of that cool stuff to extend your Office capabilities and all the things that are Office. So check that out.
Fantastic. Thank you. Lou, Curtis, always a pleasure. And always a pleasure with you. That's right, the people who come back each week to listen or watch This Week at Enterprise Tech. Without you, we wouldn't have a show. We wouldn't have had all these years of geeking out to the enterprise goodness, and we want to do a little something for you. We want to make it easier for you to get This Week at Enterprise Tech and your weekly dosage of IT. Just go to our show page at twit.tv/Twiat. That's T-W-I-E-T, This Week in Enterprise Tech. There you'll find all of our back episodes available for download, as well as our notes. If you wanted to know the links to the stories that we talked about, if you want to find the contact information for the people who have been guests, or if you just want to subscribe, and yes, please subscribe because it's the best way to support the show. Again, go to twit.tv/Twiat. Also, thanks to everyone here in the studio who makes this show possible. That's Lisa and Leo, who have allowed us to continue doing This Week in Enterprise Tech all these years. That's the engineering staff, people like Burke and Alex and Jammer B. And yes, our TD, our fabulous TD who lives in the room. Kevin, this is the time of the show where we offer you a chance at redemption. We ask you a little bit about what happened in the show to see if you were paying attention. So today I'm going to ask you, what is the Whole Foods version of JIT?
I don't know because I've been slacking.
Okay, I'm not even going to justify that one. That's wrong. You were looking for OTS. But Kevin, thanks again. We'll play again next week. Until then, I'm Father Robert Ballasaire, just reminding you that if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep Twiat.